Welcome, everybody, to the Immigration Hour. Today is July 12th, 2023. It's great to be back. Last week, I normally record on Wednesdays, and last week I was going to record, but on Tuesday, July 4th, I blew out my back in a crazy way. And so on Wednesday, I was a little high on Percocet. So I thought best not to record a podcast while one is taking Percocet. I had a little back surgery on Thursday, and now I'm fine. Better living through modern chemistry. I am very excited to be here today and not have that back pain anymore. I mean, there's obviously still a little pain, but it's you know, I was able to pick vegetables all weekend at the farm, and everything was, in fact, great. We have several topics today that I want to touch on, but none perhaps more troubling than the state of Florida's decision to create an anti-immigration law in a state which has at least maybe almost 20% of its population as immigrants. Obviously, not enough immigrants in elected office in Florida, mostly old white men. So with the Ron DeSantis's desire to be a tough guy, really, he looks like a wimp, but to be a tough guy, it looks like they have decided to go all in. Now, they should have remembered the lesson of Georgia in 2013, but they appear to simply have ignored HB 87, which was Georgia's attempt to do stupid things on immigration, several of which were struck down by the federal courts because they were unconstitutional. And there is no doubt in my mind that at least parts of this Florida law, all of it's stupid, but parts of it will, in fact, be found to be unconstitutional. Let's talk about a couple of those things and about the law itself. The law, which went into effect July 1st, so last week, says that if you provide transportation for an undocumented person, now what that means is a little unclear, from outside Florida into the state, you are now subject to a third degree felony punishable by up to 15 years in prison, regardless of whether they are family, friends, or coworkers. But in a bizarre twist, it's not a crime to provide transportation within the state to an undocumented person. Why would they do this? Well, clearly there's tons of undocumented people already in Florida, and they have to work, and you have to get brought to work. So we don't want to interrupt that, you know, that free flow of undocumented labor. We just don't want any new people being brought here. Now, obviously, there's already a federal law on this, on the transportation of undocumented people. This is likely to be preempted by the state. This is what the section says, by the way. A person commits a third degree felony when he or she, because women do this too, knowingly and willfully transports into this state an individual whom the person knows or reasonably should know has entered the United States in violation of the law and has not been inspected by the federal government since his or her unlawful entry. Now, what's stupid about this, I mean, this is obviously written people who do not understand immigration law. One does not get inspected after one has come in unlawfully. That does not happen. Maybe they were, instead of the word inspected, they were looking for, had been approved by the government to remain here because they applied for asylum or they applied for DACA. Or they apply for TPS. And this is why this is such a stupid law. It's just really written by morons. I'm sorry, Florida, but your legislature is full of morons. And your governor's a moron, too. I think that's an appropriate use of the word. Nobody's been prosecuted on this. We'll see if it happens. But here's my advice. If you are a U.S. citizen, permanent resident, somebody with work permission, and you bring a family member to go to Disney World, yeah, you can go to prison for 15 years. Don't do it. Don't go to Florida. Boycott Florida. Just say, I'm not going. If you need to go to Disney, go to California. All right. The second thing this crazy law did was say that out-of-state driver's licenses that some states give to undocumented people, for example, in New York or California or Illinois, they are no longer valid in Florida. Now, that is clearly a violation of the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution of the United States. Punto. It just is. It's a violation of that clause. It will be struck down. But if you're undocumented, traveling to or driving in Florida with a license from their state, you clearly need a problem. You probably have a problem. Don't go to Florida. Or if you're in Florida, you should leave. The law also put into place E-Verify for companies with more than 25 employees. Georgia's had a 10-employee rule for 10 years, and it's never been enforced. So completely useless. The law also bars local municipalities from giving community IDs. I don't know how people are doing that. Some be not a big deal. But here's the kicker. Hospitals are required to ask for patient immigration status. You're not required to answer the question, though. So obviously you can decline to answer the question. You have a right to access emergency healthcare. But again, this is meant to dissuade people from using healthcare. Yeah, I'd rather have you die of the bubonic plague than go to the emergency room and tell them that you're undocumented, or don't tell them at all. So if you're in Florida, leave. Georgia would welcome you. We have lots of space. We have lots of jobs. We would love to have you come to our state. Please join us. That is the nightmare nature of the Florida law. Now, I will say the Florida law is under litigation right now. A group in Florida from the Southern Poverty Law Center is seeking an injunction to bar this crime from taking effect. Lawsuit, it's all it is, but it should be interesting. We'll see what happens. But it's clearly one of the dumbest things a state legislature has done this year. And that's a long list, by the way, a long list of things. Next thing I want to chat with today is about DACA again. We still do not have a decision from Judge Hannon on the DACA case, which is not unusual. As I talked 2 weeks ago, that we're probably not going to have a decision, my guess, until September or maybe October. A reporter did a recent article, talked to myself and two of my really good friends and extraordinary immigration lawyers, Angelo Paparelli and Stephen Yale Lair. So Andrew Kriebaum from Bloomberg talking about the U.S. versus Texas case. Angelo said, I don't know if DACA will survive in light of U.S. versus Texas. I think it should. But what do you mean it won't survive? I think U.S. versus Texas actually is quite the opposite. We took interest. We read the same case. We know the same law. We took opposite takes. My opinion, I think that Hannon's going to have a hard time getting around the Supreme Court's decisions because states don't dictate federal government immigration policy or federal enforcement policy. That's what U.S. versus Texas was about. DACA is an enforcement policy. That's what it is. They require people to come in. You register with the government. Every 2 years you re-register in return for us knowing where you are in the enforcement because you're undocumented. We're going to let you work and we're going to let you travel. That is perfectly well within the enforcement realm of the law. I just don't see how the judge gets around that. I hopefully the government lawyers are filing their briefs on this issue. I just hope they are. And my other friend, Stephen Yale Lair, who's just really a tremendous law professor, a brilliant immigration lawyer, he said that the work permits through the DACA could be an issue the conservative judges to ignore the Supreme Court ruling. He said, quote, the Supreme Court hinted in the Texas prosecutor discretion case that they might come out the opposite way in DACA litigation concerns more than simply enforcement discretion. See, I don't read that the same way. But again, you have a judge who wants to end DACA. So he could end DACA. I just don't see it happening. It would be immoral, unjust, and certainly, hopefully, be more of an impetus for Congress to do something. So there you are, DACA and SCOTUS, and that's kind of where you are on that issue. Now, the next thing, really important, is about the H-1Bs. You all know, if you listen to the podcast regularly, that I FOIA'd the cap numbers, the cap filings for fiscal year 2022. I wanted to know how many were filed after the government selected the winners of the lottery. And I remember in 2022, there was, for that fiscal year, there was about 370,000 visa applicants. Fiscal year 2023, there was about 500,000 applicants. And for fiscal year 2024, there's like 700,000 applicants. I wonder how many applied after they were selected. And then, of course, how many they approved and when they approved them. So I did get my response to get a response. And of course, the government didn't respond to my FOIA. So I had to sue them personally. And I did, in fact, sue them personally. Cost me $402. That's what you cost to file a lawsuit. But what the heck? I'll do it. Government responded at the 60-day mark and asked for a little bit more time. I said, you know, I'm not a jerk. I'll give you a little bit more time. And they came back within the time frame and gave me my response. But they gave me fiscal year 2023 H-1B numbers, not fiscal year 2022 numbers. Now, I'm not fully releasing that data yet, but I will tell you that they have, as of the data that they gave me for fiscal year 2023, they still had over 4,000 pending applications, which is really weird because fiscal year 2023 started last October. And all the filings were in by, I think it was September 30th. So a little strange that they're still adjudicating 4,000 cases. I will also tell you that the approval rate for those that they have adjudicated is almost 98%. Very, very high, much higher than I anticipated. But once I get the fiscal year 2022 numbers, we're going to go ahead and release the data and then let you make your own conclusions about the H-1B lottery. I will tell you in general, however, the numbers to me for fiscal year 2023 confirm that, in fact, there's a massive abuse in the system, that immigration is not doing anything to responsibly respond to that abuse of the system. And the threats recently by USCIS to find the foreign national committed fraud when various employers submitted cases on their behalf is suspect at best, immoral at worst, but is happening out there. Remember, if you're an H-1B person and FDNS comes to your business, you have no legal obligation to talk to them at all. Your employer has no legal obligation to talk to them. In fact, we would encourage you not to talk to them. Nothing good comes out of an FDNS audit. Nothing good comes out of that. All right. The next item is, I think, the biggest news of the month, which started on Monday. And this is the Biden administration creating a new program to allow some Central Americans, this would be Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, as well as Colombians, to legally enter the United States. This initiative, and now this is limited, will allow people to fly from those countries to the U.S. if they have relatives in the U.S. who are citizens or residents, and those relatives have filed visa applications for them. Now, when he's used to a relatives, we're talking about direct line people. So these are brothers and sisters of U.S. citizens. These are parents, spouses, and children of U.S. citizens and permanent residents and their sibling and their spouses and their kids. So this is the whole family-based category. So immediate relatives, they're going to come anyway, so put them aside. Family-based first preference, adult unmarried children of citizens, waiting line 7 to 7 years. Family-based second preference, spouses and minor children are 21 of permanent residents. They have about a 3-year wait right now. Family-based second preference, adult unmarried children of residents. They've got about a 7-year wait right now. These are married children of U.S. citizens. These are family-based third preference. They have about a 14-year wait right now. And then finally, brothers and sisters, they have about a 15-year wait. Those are the categories that are eligible from these three, from these four countries to come to the United States. But what is the big, are they going to get on a plane tomorrow? No, no, they're not. That's not happening. Now, this is up to 100,000 people, but here's the deal. There probably aren't 100,000 people in the program. And this requires, one, that the U.S. relative have filed and been approved for a petition. Filed and been approved for a petition. And that petition is then sent to the National Visa Center of the Department of State. And the Department of State is in charge of sending out invitations to participate in this program. This is about 70,000 people, supposedly, that qualify, 17,400 Colombians, 32,000 El Salvadorans, 12,800 Guatemalans, and 10,700 Hondurans in the waiting list with approved petitions. But here's the deal that nobody's mentioned. There are likely hundreds of thousands of unapproved petitions pending at the USCIS. Yes, in fact, immigration indicates in their most recent data that they have 2 million pending forms I-130. All these are applied for on the form 130. 2 million pending forms I-130 at their service centers that have not been adjudicated. Now, how many of those reference these four countries? Nobody really knows. Presumably the government knows. This is what's crazy about this system. Immigration took the money from these people. So immigration took in 2 million cases that are pending. On average, they pay, let's say, $500 a piece. So they took in $1 billion. That's $1 billion, if my math is right. What happened to that money? What money are you going to use to adjudicate 2 million cases? I don't know. That's a great question. Where's that money coming from? 2 million cases. Now, immigration has purposely slowed down the processing of I-130s, especially for these long waiting periods. So they might take 10 years to adjudicate the I-130. And their thought process, as I understand it, is, well, then these people, their kids, if there are kids involved, can benefit from the Child Status Protection Act. But now, if this program is expanded, well, they could be in the United States, and they could be waiting out the process here. And yes, they might age out, but they would be in the U.S. and find other ways to immigrate. So this is, it's a great program, but it's befuddled by USCIS mismanagement and the opaqueness of the Department of State, quote, invitation process. Wow. You know, it's a great program. We'll see if it runs. The last thing I wanted to mention in our podcast today was the new announcement. This is actually really good news, only good news. If you are applying for immigration benefits, you have to take what's called biometrics, your picture and your fingerprints. Those are set randomly by the government. And you're at their beck and call. You can now reschedule those online. Woo! Immigration moves into the 21st century for one tiny little thing. So that's really good news as well. More details are on the uscis.gov website. I got an email from one of our listeners who wanted me to take a deep dive on legislation, which I'm going to do next week. I didn't have time to prepare this week. So next week, we're going to take a deep dive on where we are on the pending legislation in Congress, what each of the bills are, what prospects they have for passage. And I'll see if I can't get a special guest to accompany me as we analyze these bills. But until next week, this is Charles Cook here at Cook Baxter. As part of the Immigration Hour, it really is a delight to be here. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.